The greatest unresolved problem confronting the church today is the unemployment problem. There are too many drones in the divine hive. Wherever I go across America and around the world, the screaming need is for leadership. I do not know a church that can afford to hang a sign out its front door, "No help wanted." Why? Why this shortage of personnel? To me, it is inconceivable that God should call a church into existence and that that church should languish for lack of leadership. We have to be very careful we do not charge God foolishly. The fault is not God's, it is ours. God is still in the process of dispensing gifts, but the church is not in the process of developing gifts. The older I become in the faith, the more impressed I am with the subtlety of Satan. Whenever he fogs, he always fogs in the area of the crucial, never in the area of the trivial. And he has fogged the church in terms of the doctrine and dynamic of spiritual gifts. I think our dilemma is quite similar to that confronted by the early church in the book of Acts. When they said to them, "Have you received the Holy Spirit?" they said, "Friend, we have not so much as heard there is a Holy Spirit." And when I say to a man, "What's your spiritual gift?" he says, "My what?" Friend, I work for Railway Express. I mean, I'm an engineer. I teach school. I know. What's your spiritual gift? My judgment that most people have not even heard there is such a thing as a spiritual gift, much less know what theirs is, much less be involved in the process of developing and employing that gift. I think one of our great needs is the need to return to the truth found in Ephesians 4. And we want to look there for just a few moments. The book of Ephesians tells you how to live a heavenly life in a hell-like world. Like many of Paul's epistles, it has a major theme right down the middle. The first three chapters describe, as you know, the believer's wealth in Jesus Christ. Beginning at chapter 4 and going through chapter 6, the apostle turns to discuss the believer's walk. And you will note it's a walk in the midst of a warfare. I call this section God's Orthopedics Clinic. It teaches you how to walk. This section deals with our calling. This section with our conduct. The amazing thing is to note where in this book the section on spiritual gifts is found. You will note that the whole section on the believer's walk is launched by a concentrated revelation of the place and function of spiritual gifts. To be ignorant of this is to be out of it, as far as significant Christian experience. Now, every now and then you run into somebody who says, the really important thing is your doctrine, and your doctrine will automatically result in experience. I could only wish that were true. Paul gives the lie to this in verse 1 of chapter 4 when he says, I therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you that you walk worthily. You will underline this little word. It is a translation of the word axia, a Greek word which means to have equal weight with. Paul says, I want you to let your conduct have equal weight with your calling. He's built this substantial foundation, not in order to build a shack upon it, not a chicken coop, but a skyscraper. And he wants you to be as obsessed with doing the truth of the word as you are with knowing it. To know and not to do is not to know at all, in the New Testament sense. Now, you will notice that he adds that this walk is to be with all lowliness and meekness, with long-suffering, forbearing one another in love. Please note, he does not say with all Bible study, prayer, personal witnessing. He is talking here about the product that prayer, Bible study, and witnessing should produce. And you will notice every one of these four characteristics involves interpersonal relationships. That's what he's talking about in spiritual gifts. A relationship to other members in the body. And if spiritual gifts are going to function, you will need meekness. You will need long suffering. You will have to forbear one another with love. And then he goes into a section I wish we had time to expound for you, but let me summarize it in this way. In the verses preceding verse 11, his basic proposition is this. God gives gifts to men, and he gives gifted men to the church. Now, how do those gifted men function in the church? This is spelled out in verses 11 through 16. And I want to look with you at this section in a concentrated way. I provided for you a mechanical layout. We teach our students at the seminary to construct a grammatical layout of a passage in order to reveal the grammatical structure which in turn conveys the thinking, the mentality of the writer. And I think it helps so much to open this passage for our understanding. Beginning at verse 11, the apostle summarizes this first section dealing with the dispensing of gifts. God gives gifts to men, He gives gifted men to the church. And here you have a list of four of the gifts. Now it is very obvious that this is merely a selective list, not an exhaustive list. You ought to study 1 Corinthians 12 and Romans 12 together with Ephesians 4, the three major passages dealing with spiritual gifts in the New Testament. Romans 12, 1 Corinthians 12, and Ephesians 4. And by combining these, you will find a complete list of New Testament gifts. I take it these are gifts involving leadership function in the church. You will notice that the pastors and the teachers are not two gifts. If you are ever explaining this to an individual, you perhaps could write it in this way. It is the pastor-teacher gift. There's one noun controlling both articles. This is not two gifts. It's the pastor-teacher gift. God gives gifts to men. He gives gifted men to the church, such as pastor and teacher. Now, beginning at verse 12, he turns to the subject of the developing of the gifts he has dispensed by these gifted men. And you will notice on the diagram, there are three major dependent clauses. For the perfecting of the saints, till we all attain, and in order that we may be no longer children, but may grow up. I want to put a word behind each of these in order to help you summarize. The first of these deals with the process of developing spiritual gifts. How does God develop the gifts which He gives to every believer? Well, Paul says He gave these gifted men to the church for the perfecting of the saints. When I first used to preach, I had a wonderful three-point sermon. Point number one, for the perfecting of the saints. Point number two, under the work of ministry. Point number three, under the building up of the body of Christ. It was a lovely sermon. Just one problem. It wasn't Paul. And this is one of the dangers of studying the original language, because it acts as an awful lot of sermon. The second two clauses are dependent clauses. And I want to translate it for you in order to convey the sense. Paul says he gives gifts to men and gifted men to the church for the equipping of the saints for their work of the ministry, for their building up of the body of Christ. You see, every believer is in the ministry. Every believer has a ministry. Not a monopoly, but a ministry. Every believer is to be involved in the process of building not tearing down. That's the difference of day and night in functioning in the body. This process is one of equipping. Let me teach you a little Greek this morning. You ready for that? First thing to note is that this is a fishing term. It's used in the Gospels of the mending of broken nets. It's a very expressive figure to describe the function of a gifted man building into the life of an individual. Secondly, it is a medical term. Luke uses it to refer to a compound fracture in which bones are completely out of joint and need to be brought back so that they will knit together. But it is also a nautical term. Paul uses it this way in Acts. To refer to the outfitting of a ship for a journey. Here's a ship about to take across the Mediterranean. Well, there are no Safeway stores in the middle of the Mediterranean. So it has to put on everything that it will need from the time it leaves this port till it gets there. You want to know a good description of an ass? I mean a functioning New Testament nav. Here it is. He mends broken nets. He sets broken bones. And he outfits for the journey of life. Isn't that beautiful? That's worth giving your life to. Isn't it? Well, are you asleep already? Isn't it?
Yeah.
Great. That's what I like. Real conviction. This is the difference, my friends, between a ministry of addition and a ministry of multiplication. In a ministry of addition, you are doing the work of a ministry. In a ministry of multiplication, you are equipping saints for their work of ministry. What's the average pastor doing? He's doing the work of a ministry. And he's just about to kill himself. The finest specimen for somebody's psychopathic ward you've ever seen. Just about ready to back up the white wagon. The boys with the coats come out, carry him away. Don't criticize him, by the way. He needs your sympathy. He's a terribly frustrated individual. Some time ago, I was in a pastor's study. I had been out for an hour and came back, and the pastor was in the study. The door was open. He didn't know I was slipping in a carpeted floor, and so I stepped up to the door, and here's the guy folding church bulletin. Pulls this one over, and he picks the next one. He had a deacon there right in front of each one. And all of a sudden, he looked up, and he saw me. He said, "Think of that, Hendricks. 4 years in seminary to fold church bulletin." And, of course, I was in a delightful position to do what perhaps you couldn't do under these circumstances. I said, "And whose fault is that?" And it launched us on a fantastic discussion. Dr. John Bright, professor of Old Testament at Union Theological Seminary in Richmond, Virginia, Southern Presbyterian School, was asked some time ago, what is the purpose of a seminary? And he replied, the primary purpose of a seminary today is to unfit men for the ministry as commonly conceived by the churches today. Our churches are pouring their ministers into a role for which God has never called them. And they're accepting it. So we got them mowing the lawn, folding the church bulletins, passing out the hymnals, dusting the pews, doing everything in the world, things that need to be done, but which are interfering with the ministry to which God has called him. And where are the saints? They're up in the stands. Bud Wilkinson was in Dallas not too long ago. You will recall he was coach of the University of Oklahoma for many years and connected with the president's physical fitness program. And a young buck of a reporter from the television station interviewed him. He said, Mr. Wilkinson, what would you say is the contribution of modern football to physical fitness? To which he replied, absolutely nothing. And this poor guy was so nonplussed. He did the only thing a guy could do under the circumstances. He said, well, would you care to elaborate? Certainly. My definition of football is 22 men on the field, desperately needing rest, and 40,000 men, people in the stands, desperately needing exercise. I thought, what a description of the church. That's it. Few people down on the field, compulsively, neurotically active. And the rest of them up in the stands, spectating. My friend, God never gave a spiritual gift with which to spectate in the stands. He gave a gift with which to function in the body. So the few down here that are working, it's 15 to 20% across America. The average church is operated by 15 to 20% of its membership. The result is all that should be spread over the rest is concentrated on these people. We took a survey in a church in Dallas, found one layman who had 8 full-time jobs. Mind you, a layman who can only give fringe areas of his time. We started to take the jobs away. We got him down to 2. I met him on the parking lot one day. Said, Hendrick, this is fantastic. Imagine, I'm enjoying the work of the Lord. Well, that is amazing. Very few are. Most of us are enduring it. Meet the guy, how you doing? Well, pretty good under the circumstances. What are you doing under there? Where he spends his time. Under it. Boy, he said, Hendricks, this is thrilling. He said, it's like getting saved all over again. And then he added, but the thrilling thing is not because for the first time I'm efficient in my ministry, but now there are 6 other people who were in the stand who are now down on the playing field. Our problem is frequently we are paying ministers for the privilege of robbing us of our ministry. I love to preach on this passage to pastors, as I do so frequently, and I speak on the subject, have you never read Ephesians 4? I remind them, on 11 different occasions in the Gospels, Jesus Christ said to the most well-read people of his time, have you never read? Of course they read. They spent their life reading. But they didn't understand what they read. I was presenting this truth out in at Hume Lake, up in the High Sierras, to about 290 pastors. And we were having a discussion at the conclusion of the session. It must have been about 20 people standing around. One elderly man sitting up near the front, I watched him all the time. He sat there and the tears were coursing down his face all the time I was speaking. I could tell that he was identifying that this was personal to him. When I got through and this little group was formed, he said to the group and to me, he said, "You know, I've been 34 years in the ministry, and only in the last 3 years have I been applying the principles of Ephesians 4. And he said, "I have seen God accomplish more in the last 3 years of my ministry than the previous 31 put together." And there was a man sitting over on the sideline and said, "Boy, I'm so thankful to God that I get the message early. They never gave it to me in seminary." But he said, "When I graduated from seminary and took a church, there was a guy in the area who was a navigator who built a friendship with me, who didn't club me with it, but who got interested in my problem, my need, my concern. And he shared with me the basic principle of this truth. He helped me to see the role that God called me to in my ministry." Friends, we've been talking about this these days. Don't let those prejudices psych you out. You got something to offer. The question is, can you sell it? Can you communicate it? Something desperately needed by the church today. Can you get interested enough in a pastor to get close enough to him where without his losing faith, you can share with him? You can help him. I find very few pastors resist this idea. Most of them are so frustrated, they're looking for anything they can get their hands on that will help them. But who's the person that's going to help me? Not knock me, but help me to do the job. Now, the next verse gives to us the product of this developing process. And if you want to write beside this, will you note there are three things that are the product of this process? And please note, you cannot get these products without this process. The first mark is that of unity. The second is that of maturity. And the third is that of conformity. So many times people say to me, "How can I tell when I have a New Testament ministry?" My friend, it's not as hard as some people would have you believe. There are clear-cut marks. How can you tell if you are equipping saints for a work of ministry? My friend, just because you have a man-to-man ministry does not mean you are equipping saints. But I'll give you some yardsticks by which to measure it. The first thing, you got a group, is that group being united? Are they moving together? Secondly, are they making progress? Are they growing up? And third, are they becoming more like Jesus Christ? If they are, you've got proof positive you have a New Testament ministry. These are the characteristics of our churches: unity. And some of them are decimated. They're fractured. There are five churches within a church. each pulling in different directions. Maturity, now you have protracted infancy. Conformity, right, to the world. But they're not becoming more like Jesus Christ. And my friends, I tell you, these are the most searching marks of your ministry you can ever apply. And you can't escape them. That group congealing. Isn't it thrilling to work with a group of individuals? May only be five, six people that you're building into. And boy, as you progress down the road, then they just get so close together and so knitted that, man, they almost act as one. Their hearts are welded together. You can see them taking giant steps in the faith. Why, the guy's only 2 years old in the Lord. And man, he's way beyond the elders of the church. We got an odious situation in our church right now that I confronted the elders with some time ago. We're leading people to Christ like crazy. They're coming in to the church in a steady stream. And you know, the guy comes into the church and he comes Sunday morning to the worship service and they announce there's an evening service. So the guy shows up. I mean, he doesn't know enough not to. Comes to the evening service and we announce there's a prayer meeting. So he shows up. He doesn't know enough not to. The guy showed up the other day who had been saved on Friday night. Came Sunday morning, Sunday night, and shows up Wednesday night for prayer meeting. So we had a Bible study and after we came out, he said to me, Howie, you think they'll mind if I pray? I said, mind? That's what we're here for. Yeah, he said, I know, but I don't know the lingo. I can't say it like you do. You got a problem. Said, you don't have any problems. Thank God for that. Well, he came into the group, I could tell. He was really threatened. And I could sense the guy really wanted to pray, but he just, you know, quite couldn't screw up the courage. So I just put my hand over on his knee, sitting next to me, squeezed it. And he started out, Lord, this is Jim. I said, I'm the guy that met you last Friday night. I really thought he was going to give God a zip code. Boy, did he ignite a prayer meeting. See, the rest of us were saying prayer. Terrific. I said to the elders, gentlemen, we got a real dilemma. We're seeing men come to know Christ, and they're coming here, and they're coming to prayer meeting. You know what their conclusion is? We grow old enough and mature enough to be qualified to be an elder. Then we won't have to come to prayer meeting either. I really think, my friends, that sometimes the greatest penalty on a new Christian is to be exposed to older ones. If you could just keep them away from the spoiled brat, friend, he's liable to be a tiger. Becoming more like Jesus Christ. Boy, what a test for your ministry. You can't get that product, my friend, without that process. It just doesn't come. Third section deals with the purpose. Stated negatively and positively to emphasize the cruciality of the truth. That we be no longer children, notice the contrast, but may grow up. It's children versus adults. The goal of this process is to develop spiritual adults. And I've often thought, wouldn't it be a farce if we dress people in our churches according to their spirituality? You know, here's Brother So-and-so saved, lo, these many years, still running around in his rompers, still waving his rattle, still cooing, looking at his fingers. of an elder in the church saved 34 years, I remember so distinctly because he done furrow and testimony meeting, saved 34 years ago. Psalm 23:1, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Sit down. And you know, in testimony meetings, I mean, boy, kids pop up like this, you know. So while he's unfurling, this little kid pops up and says, Psalm 23:1, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. And I watch his elder sit back down in the chair as if to say, good night, there goes my verse. And you know, I used to think to myself, man, in 34 years, you'd think he'd take time to learn a second verse. Know what I mean? Just in case he got caught. It's only this product, producing this product, that will ever develop spiritually mature people. You can't improve on God's method. We don't have God's results because we're ignoring God's method. Now, I wish we had time to go into the rest, but let me just share with you this last section. We're to grow up in all things unto him. This is the pattern. Who is the head? Even Christ, from whom the body, notice, the strong head determines the sturdy body. Body that's fitly framed and it's knit together. Has all of the parts, and all of the parts are functioning. Now, beginning with through that which every joint supplieth, you have three prepositional phrases. Now, I give you a word to put beside each that you can use perhaps in communicating this to others. The first phrase emphasizes the importance of cooperation. Every joint is supplied. The second phrase emphasizes the truth of coordination. Paul says that each several part is making its increase. And the third word, unto the building up of itself in love. I like to use the word completion. You have all of the parts completely coordinated, accomplishing an objective. That's a good biblical definition of a group. And if you want a choice illustration of this, turn back in your study sometime to Nehemiah 3, one of those chapters you wonder why it's in the Bible. Got a lot of names, most of which you can't pronounce. But the interesting thing in Nehemiah 3 is that Nehemiah was instrumental in taking the priests and the people and the rulers, welding them together cooperatively to get the job done of building the wall. That's quite a task. But you can have cooperation without coordination. Here we are in a football team, we're losing 68-0. We get back in the huddle, we say, man, we need some touchdowns. Let's cooperate. Everybody together now. We're going for TD territory. Right. So the end says, I've been waiting all season to run the end around play. That's the one I'm going to do. Fullback says, look, throwing horse around with this kind of stuff. Let's go right through the center. Anybody knows you pick up 4 or 5 yards of the clip, you're eventually going to get there. Quarterback says, let's take them by surprise. Let's throw a quick pass. See, they're all cooperating, but they're not coordinated. The only difference between a mob and an army is organization. Coordination. Now, if you will look in Nehemiah 3, you will discover 31 times in the text the little expression, next unto him, next unto him, next unto him. It's a beautiful picture.
Can you imagine what would happen in the average church if we say, hey, let's go build the wall. Roger, we all run over here, falling all over each other. Or some operator saying, look, boy, let's take the water gate. Let's face it. It's going to get hot out there. It's a good place to be. Another guy says, look, Mac, I don't know what we're going to do or not going to do, but let's not take that fish gate. I want to smell that all day. And the dear elderly people say, let's take the old gate. That's the one that brings back the memory. And you have exactly what you have in our churches today. Nehemiah said, look, you people live over there at that section of the wall. You build that section. It's convenient. Furthermore, if they're coming through the wall, they're going to be sure they're not coming through that section of the wall. They're going to build that terribly well. You people live over that side, you build that section. You people over there, all the way around. With the result that in 52 days, a remarkably short period of time, they built the wall. But it's interesting that in the same passage, 41 times, you have the completed form of the verb to show they finished the task. Job finished theirs, they finished theirs, finished theirs, the result is all the way around. The job was done. This is exactly what you have here. Everybody functioning. Everybody coordinated in terms of his gift. Everybody working toward the objective of getting the job done. My friend, that's an invincible combination. I ran across an interesting article recently I thought I'd share with you because more than anyone else, you will appreciate this. Now, if this appeared in the Navigator log, this wouldn't jolt me. But this appeared in one of the leading denominational magazines. The first century expansion of the church, when with all odds against it, it refused to be stamped out by the power of the Roman Empire, but instead caught the hearts and imaginations of men, from slaves to those of the emperor's household, this was the result of the contagious enthusiasm of rank and file Christians, the ministry of the saints, not of an ordained priestly class. The fastest growing churches in our day are not those with the greatest ecclesiastical organization, the biggest overhead, the most executives, and the best trained clergy, but rather are what we call sect churches, storefront, evangelistic groups, where the functions of the ministry are carried on by members of the congregation. Though many of these groups show a seriously limiting lack of insight into the full meaning of the gospel, they do accept with sincerity and exercise with zeal the call to the ministry. But we need not be afraid of their competition, because as they grow big enough to get better organized, they generally settle down, put more of the ministry in the hands of better trained clergymen, develop a bureaucracy, and become as respectable as the rest of us. Now listen to that. I mean, mind you, and I'll tell you in a moment who was the guy that wrote this and some interesting implications. Then God must raise up another group. You hear that? He's really saying that maybe you came to the kingdom for such a time as this. To challenge us to minister rather than to be ministered to. Am I suggesting that we sell all our buildings, move into upstairs lofts, shout gospel songs, and disregard our great denominational literature? Hardly. We would be missing the point if we did those things. Buildings, organizations, curricular materials are tools to be used in the work of the ministry. We need the best tools available. Perhaps then we should fire the minister. It could be that would help. It wouldn't be the first time A church has had a surge of new life simply because the clergyman was not there depriving the members of the privilege of using God's gift. Sometimes one of the greatest favors a minister can do is to get out of the way and let the people have the satisfaction of carrying out their Christian responsibilities themselves. Any so-called church that cannot entrust to its members the job of communicating the faith is really not a church at all. That is a company of disciples, but is a mission field in need of an evangelist to come in and win a few converts so there will be those equipped as saints to do the work of the ministry. And 2 months later, he was relieved of the editorship. You know, I recognize, my friend, and perhaps I can say it better than you can because of my position. I recognize that with any organization, there is a danger of having an exaggerated opinion of yourself. And this is lethal. There is also a danger of not having a sense of destiny and of call. And it is my judgment that God has called the navigators into existence for such a time as this. I have been chasing through the history of the Nav, and the interesting thing is the timing of this organization. At the very time when we have the least amount of involvement. And I think you need to speak instead of stuttering. I think you need to communicate instead of crawling under a rock. I think you need to launch an advance instead of beating a retreat. But how you do that is dreadfully important. Because in my judgment, the future of many of our churches is at stake. And many thinking men are asking, is the church obsolete? Is this a relic of another generation with no cutting edge in our? That depends on whether we put all of the functions into the hands of one individual and rob the saint of the privilege of functioning with the gift that God has given to them. Now, we want to take a break, and if you'll be back a couple minutes before a quarter of, we'll go into the subject of what is a group. Phillips Brooks expressed it so succinctly. Do not pray for easier lives. Pray to be stronger men. Do not pray for powers equal to your tasks. Pray for tasks equal to your power. Then the living of your life shall be no miracle. But you shall be a miracle. Every day you shall wonder at that which is wrought in you by the grace of God. The burden of every member in a Christian group should be trusting God for miracles in men, in me. Whenever God changes any individual in a group, he changes the group. As the individual matures, the group matures. There is no ministry apart
from men.
Yesterday we asked the very practical question, what is a group? We discovered, first of all, a group involves people. People who are different, dramatically different. And these differences account for the distinctives and the dynamics of a group. A group has dynamics because the people are different. There's a difference in background, a difference in need, each individual a world of need, and vast differences in personality. And as we pointed out, we must become not only students of our message, but also students of men, of the people to whom we wish to communicate this message. Now, this morning, we want to look at a second distinctive feature of a group. Not only is a group comprised of people, it must also have a clear-cut purpose. Lauren provided an excellent biblical backdrop for this and last night's message. We don't beat the air. And much of Christian work is characterized by what I call the slimy ooze of indefiniteness. There is a lack of accomplishment, which is the result of good intention without exactly knowing what, how, and why. The result is you end up with a group keeping mental housekeeping in a revolving door. You develop a brand of individual who has both feet firmly planted in midair. This is a subtle thing. I'm committed to a personalized ministry, to a ministry with groups. But I have discovered if you do not have clear objectives, you are just as foggy working with individuals and with groups as you are in preaching or teaching to 500 without an objective. See, it's possible to have the objective to work man to man and never get the job done. I was discovering that I spent a lot of time with men, but I had no accomplishment. My objective was to spend time with men, but it's got to be more sharply focused than that. When you spend time with men, precisely what do you hope to accomplish? When I convene a group, what is my objective? Where am I going? I just dropped out of a group not too long ago for this very reason. They met the first Saturday of every month. So one day, I asked a nasty question. I said, men, what's the purpose of this group? And the chairman of the meeting said, Brother Hendricks, that's a very insightful question. Brother Brown, you've been here longer than anyone else. What is the purpose of this group? And Brother Brown stuttered and stammered for a while. And then he said, well, Brother Jones, you've been here as long as I have. What would you say is the purpose of the group? And he was equally veiled. We went all the way around the group with no one able to express what's the purpose of this group. When we got all the way around, I said, well, the motion is in order. I would like to move that we disband this meeting. Oh, no, we can't do that. Why not?
Well, we've been meeting for 12 years.
Well, I said, that seems to me like we've got 12 of the finest reasons why we ought to quit. This group needs a quiet to middle, ashes to ashes and dust to dust. So I bailed out. They're still meeting. Every Saturday morning.
My friends, do not multiply meetings. Make them meaningful. You have no right to ask an individual to come to a group or a personal counseling situation unless you have taken the time
to formulate some objective. The goals of a group must be well formulated. They must be clearly understood. They must be personally accepted. Well formulated, clearly understood, and personally embraced. We've asked a question here in terms of the purpose. Does everyone accept the purpose of this group? Well, this depends on a number of things. In fact, it depends on three searching questions. Number one, do your group members understand the group's purpose? Not enough to have one. Unless they understand it. Why are we meeting? Secondly, do they feel that the purpose is important? And my friends, this is very critical if you are going to reach intelligent people. Now, you may get a collection of individuals with about 80 to 85 who will meet just because you suggest they meet. They enjoy the fellowship. But if you're dealing with a group of people with 130 above, I'll clue you, they're not about to meet unless they are convinced that this is a worthwhile meeting. This is a place where I want to put my time. And there isn't a person in this room who's even had a limited exposure with the NAVs who hasn't proven this firsthand. And that is, you've got somebody in your group who's plugged into you and plugged out of the church because he thinks what's going on down at the church is Mickey Mouse. And he thinks what's going on in your group is really significant. And that's why he comes. If you cannot communicate to this individual, this is worth a night of your week, then, my friend, you are culpable before God by dislodging this man from his home. I will never wrench a man away from his home unless I have a worthy objective. Because I'm complicating his problem rather than solving it. He needs another meeting like he needs a hole in the head. But he needs a cause to which he can commit himself. The third question you ought to raise is, does he feel the purpose can be achieved? In other words, are we shooting for the moon? Or do we have this thing down where we can get a hold of it? Now, I'd like to give you three questions that I use in determining whether you have a good objective. I will not allow an individual in my training program to go into any group or to work man-to-man with any individual without showing me and convincing me that he has a worthwhile objective to spend this man's time. And there are three characteristics of a good group objective to me. Number one, it must be brief enough to be remembered.
And this is sometimes humorous.
I asked a man not too long ago. He was leaving the seminary. What's your objective? Oh, just a minute, Prof. I got it right here.
Hold it.
You got it right here. You can't remember it?
Yeah.
It's right down here. I wrote it out. 5 sentences. I said, my friend, if you can't remember it, I got news for you. You'll never accomplish it. So you got to go back and say, now, let's see, what was that there I'm going to accomplish here? Yes, here it is. Read it. Walk out. No, it's got to be right here. And I often say to this guy, look, my friend, if I come over to your home at 3:30 in the morning and stand you on your head and say, boo, what's your objective for today's meeting? You'd spit it out like that. I was preaching some time ago in a pulpit in a rather large church, and I was completely derailed in the middle of my message. For I moved my Bible up and it exposed a little plaque on the pulpit. And the plaque read, "What in the world are you trying to do to these people?" Next time I saw my pastor friend, I said, "Friend, what in the world is the point of this question on the pulpit?" That I was preaching for 12 years in this church without a clear-cut objective every time I walked into the pulpit. So I devised this question so that every time I look down, it forces my hand. What do you want them to think? What do you want them to be? What do you want them to do? And my friends, if you don't know, there is no baptism of understanding that takes place at that door. It's got to be brief enough for you to remember it so that you go in consciously to accomplish it. Second characteristic, it must be clear enough to be written down. Now, a pencil or a pen is a mental crowbar. It forces you to think and to think clearly. It was Socrates who said, "Generalities are a refuge for a weak mind." If you run that through your mind, you'll quit saying "and so forth." Which is usually an indication I can't think of anything else. Clear enough so that you can write it down. I have a lot of fun in marriage counseling because I give a lot of homework. And this is the way I get people to internalize their problems. A lady walked into my office some time ago. She said, "I want out." I said, "You want out?" "I want out of my marriage." "You mean you want a divorce?" "Right." "Why, that's serious, madam. We better sit down here to find out why." I said, "I take it you're disturbed with your husband." "Oh, tremendously so." I said, "Okay. What is it that bothers you about your husband?"
"Oh, everything."
"Well, name one thing."
"Oh, I just hardly know where to begin."
"That's all right. I don't really care. Does it start anywhere, madam?"
"Oh, my, so many things. It'll take me an hour to do it."
"Well," I said, "fine, and I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll give you an assignment. Before you come back the next time, I want you to write out on a card exactly what it is that bugs you about your husband and why you want a divorce." "All right." So she took off, and I got this feedback later. This really threw her into trauma. She was really shook up. She worked 12 hours trying to devise this list. And she
read it and then tear it up and start over again and draw up another one.
So finally she brought the list in. Here was, boy. The list. Wonderful.
All right, lady, I said, let's discuss these things. Now, let's see. Point number one, the reason you want a divorce is that he won't pick up his pajamas. That's what you had down.
What's the matter? Will you strike oil here?
You must have stepped on somebody's bunion. I hate to talk in terms of personal needs, but...
See, I'm reading this to her. She wrote it down. He won't pick up his pajamas. Now, as I understand it, this is the reason you want a divorce. Is that right?
She said, that's kind of silly, isn't it?
Boy, that's tremendous insight.
I start out by saying, now look, madam, how stupid can you get? You want to get a divorce because he won't pick up his pajamas. Is that it? See, then she tunes me out. That's the last I hear from her, and she hears from me. She just goes, gets a divorce. And don't laugh, because every day of the week in Colorado Springs, Dallas, or your community, there's somebody getting divorced for just as ridiculous a reason as that. You see, it never got clear enough where they could get a hold of it objectively, have somebody else play it back to them. And I'll tell you, my friend, it's an exacting experience to write down your objective. I hope you appreciate the process through which some of your leaders go to make your work most meaningful. And these men who are really hacking away at trying to get some clear-cut objectives in terms of what do we want a contact to be and what do we expect a representative to do, this is agonizing. This is hard-nosed thinking. You put it down and you whack away at it and you correct it. It takes a lot of noodling. The interesting thing is when you finally get it down, you start accomplishing it. And that's exactly what happens in your group. You get it right down here. I know what I want to do. The interesting thing is you go in and you do it. The third characteristic. It must be specific enough to be achieved. Specific enough to be achieved. In other words, it must have realism to it. And ideally, it must have some bite-sized element. There's a great danger in this type of thing of frustrating people with objectives. Boy, I've seen people tubed out with a set of objectives. It's so far beyond a guy, you know, that he looks at these things, ooh, way up there, well, you know, we'll never make it. And he does make terrific progress, but in comparison to where he's going, you know, you can hardly see any game. So he throws in the towel. Will you bear in mind that what you are trying to do, first of all, is to find where you, the individual, the group, where they are. The next thing you find out, where are you going? To find out where they are is why it's so important to know people. To find out where you're going is why it is so important to know objectives. And this is a process. So that we have to set objectives for this level, which are achievable. Then we draw up a set of objectives for the next level of development. The reason why you are able to do certain things at this level
is because you have accomplished your objective at this level. If you fail to accomplish your objectives at this level, then you arrest the person's growth.
I'll give you a choice illustration in terms of our teaching at seminary. Down here we have courses in Greek and Hebrew. In our seminary program, you take 4 years of Greek and 3 years of Hebrew. You know, there's no problem at all teaching Greek. Greek is very simple. If the person knows English, you know our biggest problem in teaching Greek? They don't know English. So there was a failure back here in the course of his education, and we pay the penalty. And he fights the rest of his time trying to get this thing under his belt. And I've seen in an organization like this where you're trying to develop a team, man, way back here in the earlier stages of your first recruiting, you fail to accomplish basic objectives. And the result is these things plague them all the way down the line. Now, will you bear in mind that purpose always determines procedure? Now, if you look at this chart, you will note that as the group changes, that is, as it moves up this ladder, your objectives change. As your objectives change, your procedures change. Next hour, I'm going to share with you some procedural techniques for getting participation. And I'm going to give some of them to you, and you're immediately going to react and say, but you can't do that. No, you really can't. Down here. But you can up here. In fact, you must up here. But you will never accomplish it up here unless you have basic objectives down here to prepare the way for it. Concepts are developed like layers of an onion. And sometimes, to develop this individual, you have to blast before you can build. Your biggest problem educationally is dislodging error. It's not implanting truth. It's relatively simple to explain the gospel. Your problem is, after you go through the whole thing, he says, yeah, I that's terrific. I remember I was baptized once. So we go all back over the thing. He says, yeah, I really appreciate that. I joined the church when I was 12. You know what you're doing? You're explaining the gospel, but all the time you're dislodging these things, you see, that have been deeply entrenched in his thinking as to what the gospel is. And before he can sometimes embrace what the gospel is, he has to find out what it is not. And this takes a great deal of time. This is also the reason why, in teaching, you want repeated exposure. And I would suggest this principle. You ought to emphasize at each of these levels intensive rather than extensive learning. It's not that you teach him everything he needs to know, it's that you teach him what he needs to know at this level well. I have a friend of mine who is with the publications department of the Southern Baptist Convention. They put out these little training booklets. You've probably seen them. I said, what is the lifespan of one of these training booklets? He said, about 6 years. I said, what do you do at the end of 6 years? He said, we pull it. We reassign it to another individual who writes precisely the same thing, only in a different format, different illustrations. We put a new cover on. We put it out as the new book, and everybody takes the course.
He said, Hendricks, after they take it six times, even the most stupid begins to understand. Now, you think he was being sarcastic. He wasn't. He was being very insightful. And that is that you build concepts like Lair, and you repeat, and you repeat. And even though you move on to this next section, this next level, you still go back to clinch the basics, to clinch the objectives back here. Because when do you get to the place where you don't need to be reminded of the importance of a time of personal fellowship with the Lord? I've known some seminary professors who could profit from this. You never get to the place where you get beyond the point of knowing the importance of prayer. So you continue to repeat these, but you build upon them. You teach intensively what you want to teach at this level. Then you move on to the next level. Now, I want to give you three stages of getting an idea across, and then I've deliberately left some time today so that we can take some questions before we move into our last session. There are three general stages through which a person goes in the process of receiving an idea. The first stage, he rejects it. Boy, this will save you a juicy set of ulcers. You ever go out into the ministry believing that when you talk about navigator principles to an individual, when you're going to share with him some of the basics, you're automatically going to meet with resistance? You just put it down. If it doesn't come, it's a fringe benefit. Now, you see, this takes all of the, you know, the pressure out of your presentation. If I go knowing, first time I talk to this guy about this, he's going to say, yeah, that's very lovely, but... And you've already got the resistance. So you don't say, well, they never told us this at the Glen. You know, I sort of got the impression that once you learn the basics, go out and sit down with any 12 people and they'll say, "Woo! Where have you been all my life?" They may say, "From what planet did you come?" You mean we really need you? Boy, this is tremendous to get across to pastors. If I ever get the guy to realize that the first time he walks into that board, they're going to oppose it. What? They don't even know what they're opposing. This is just par for the course. I used to have a guy on my board. I'm telling you, this guy was as psychic as I've ever seen an individual. He must have had prophetic gifts. He knew before I even came in what I was going to talk about. And he was opposed to it. That's it. I remember we were trying to develop a youth program. Now, you, young people, we're doing too much for it. When I was a young person, we didn't do all that. So, you know, you come in the next time, he takes the 2x4 and drops it on your head again. And finally, I went to an older minister, and I said, "Hey, buddy, I got problems." He says, "Really?" That little benign smile of profound insight. And I shared with him my problem. He said, "Let me suggest something for you." He said, "Why don't you start a corps of prayer warriors and ask this guy to be the first one to sign your list?" So I went back. I started a corps of prayer warriors, people who would covenant to pray every day for the teenagers in our group. And I went to him. I said, you know, I don't know anybody in this church that's more interested in our young people than you are. Nobody talks more about them than you do. And I said, we have some real need for prayer, and we're trying to get a core of people who will covenant to pray every day for this. And I'd like you to be the first to sign the letter. Well, as an elder in the church, I mean, you know, gotta have them over a barrel. Okay, we sign. So he signed it. And I'd feed him little cards like this. Pray. And the old guy started to pray. You know, I've been in Texas long enough to know, friend, that a horse can't kick and pull at the same time. It's a very important discovery. And one time, we were having a social. I'm in the basement, and this old guy stuck his nose in. That was the first mistake he made. And we were playing a game, and there was a little teenage couple coming around, and as they saw him stick his nose in, they pulled him in and put him in the game. He never had so much attention in all his life. Have to know his wife to appreciate that. And the interesting thing is, this guy got on the inside. And he got an altogether different perspective. You know who are the people who have all the answers of working with young people? I'll tell you. The people that aren't working with young people. They know exactly what to do. Church is overrun with what I call self-appointed fruit inspector. Constantly running around lifting up people's leaves. How's your fruit? And they are usually people who are rejecting people. The second stage they go through, and sometimes it takes quite a bit of time, encouraging to know, they tolerate the idea. I mean, they give up on it in the sense that, okay, so I should have a quiet time. I mean, you know, this, I mean, I'm not fighting it anymore. I finally threw in the towel. I don't have one. But, I mean, I tolerate it. And furthermore, I might even allow you to talk about it. Might even invite you to our group. It'd be very nice to have you talk about the quiet time. Since I'm not doing anything, I think it's terrific that you would talk about it. And it's very interesting to watch this guy as the wind goes out of the sails and he just sits down. And he listened. See, the first time we brought it up in the board meeting, he went for your throat. And the second time, he up this side and down this side. And it kept on going. Now, you've siphoned off a lot of the venom. And now he sits there when you talk about it and grunts. The next stage through which he goes is to embrace it. He resists it. He tolerates it. Finally embraces it. And if you can hang on long enough, because with some people, this is a rather extended process. I've had students for 4 years going through this process. And the interesting thing is that when I finally get a convert, he's stronger than some of the guys who in the first class said, man, that's what I want. See, I walk into a class and I expose them to this stuff and they go right up through the ceiling. They come right up out of the chair. They fight like tigers. They go back and forth. Man, we really have session. And the interesting thing is to see this guy going through. And by the way, some of them graduate from the seminary, still resisting. And they go out into a church, and they get the baptism of fire. And then everything comes unglued, and the guy says, good night, where are those notes? Where are the notes? He's writing me a letter, he's calling me long distance. Hendricks, you got one book on Christian education that will solve my problem. Now, this is also one of the values of a reality-oriented type of approach where you dangle them in rows. We got 42 men out this summer in churches across this country. in an internship program. I can tell you exactly what's going to happen next fall when these guys hit the campus. They're going to have the kerosene poured over them and a match lit to them, and they walk into a classroom to hear everything you got to say. Because all of a sudden they now see it in terms of what we're facing out there. And before?
Yeah, nice ideas. He's a nice person. He tolerates me.
I mean, I'm one of the penalties en route of getting his degree. Now, if you can get this perspective, man, this will take a lot of the inordinate pressure with which some of you people get plagued. And the reason why often somebody wants to bail out of the NAMS or bail out of the church or bail out of whatever he's in, and that is he's lost his perspective. You're going to get resistance. It is a part of the process. Then you're going to get people in a stage where they're just tolerating it. They're, you know, in neutral. If we can just get the gear in, even into love, as far as embracing it, we're making some progress. And eventually to hot. Now, we've got about 10-15 minutes here, and I deliberately scheduled this time because I want to give you opportunity to ask some questions which can relate either to the purpose, to the people who are involved, some other aspect that we have discussed together. Yes, sir.
We talked a lot here about the purpose of the roots of the objective. Do you need the ultimate objective as well as the objective of the grant?
Very good insight. It is most important that you have the ultimate. I do not always share the ultimate with this individual at this time because he's not ready for it. See, that helps me because I know where I'm going. It may frustrate him. So I really reveal it to him just in bite-sized form. Yes? Precisely. If they can go through the process of formulating this plan themselves, then they are the ones most interested in carrying it out. Right. Otherwise, what is it? It's your plan. It's what happens to a preacher who goes into a church. It's his program. So it all comes crashing around his head. People say, what happened to your program, Pastor? That's well stated, because it's his, it's not theirs, and when he leaves, the program falls apart. This is the danger of a pastor-centered church in which the whole thing is built around him, or a leader-centered group in which everything is so built around him that when you take this dynamic out, the whole thing comes unglued. Yeah?
Would you have to take an average, so to speak, of where the men are before you can do that?
Yeah, plus the fact that oftentimes I want to work out a program with this man on a personalized basis. He may be in this group, benefiting from the group processes, but he's also going to grow on an individual basis. So I would want to deal with them from both standpoints. Yeah,
Ron? We talked about coordinating all in the body of Christ functions of the group. Could you give us an idea of when you're working with an individual, how you help him discover his gifts?
Sure, I'll be glad to. First thing I do in helping a person discover his gift is to teach him the scriptural teaching concerning gifts. Before he knows this, he's not going to find anything. That's the first place I begin. And I would say the primary passages, perhaps I refer to these. Did I? To review, what are they? Romans 12, 1 Corinthians 12, Ephesians 4. Now you have other passages, but these are your primary classical locations. and I would study Dick. All right? That's, yeah.
Can you differentiate between a person with this and a talent?
A number of us have been talking about this, and there are differences of opinion on this. It is my judgment that we overemphasize the difference to the exclusion of seeing it all sourced in God. For example, that a person has the gift of teaching who was saved when he or she was a public school teacher doesn't disturb me at all, because I happen to believe in the sovereignty of God. There's no problem to me that God gave this person a gift which he sees now in a spiritual frame of reference, with spiritual dynamics, the power of the Spirit, the ability to teach the Word, not just science. So I don't make the disjunction that some do. I recognize there are clear-cut spiritual gifts which are listed in the Scripture. I'm not sure this is an exhaustive list. I'm not sure it's even intended to be. And I think there are many things. My brother's ability here in art, I can't find listed unless you put it under the general category of the gift of help, you know, in which he is helping someone who is functioning with another gift. But I mean, it could be a natural talent which he now sees with a new dimension. In fact, that's what turned him on. He was just about ready to quit, because he said, how can I use my art for God? I mean, his point was, why don't I go get into something else where I can use it more? Well, this is a question of exposing a man. Right, first of all, is scriptural teaching. The second thing is exposing an individual to a variety of experiences. And I think this is very crucial in determining one's gift. And my illustration is usually this. Man says to me, I don't have the gift of teaching, when I talk to him about the possibility of teaching. So how do you know? God let down a sheet out of heaven one night and said, oh, no, no, I just don't have it. How do you know? Oh, just no. Did you ever teach? No, I never have. That I don't think you can tell whether you have the gift of teaching or not. Some of the finest teachers we have in some of our classes right now, if you had said to them 5 years ago, my friend, you have the gift of teaching, you know what they would have said? I know one gift you don't have, the gift of prophecy. You know what their reaction is? Who? Me teach? I got a guy right now in insurance executive teaching classes. I send my students out to watch him. He's so fantastic. I put him in the midst of the seminary students and say, become like him. This guy is tremendously communicative. 7 years, exactly. 7 years ago, this guy had never taught once. And if you had asked him, as I did, what about teaching? Thanks a lot, Howie. I love to administrate my field, but not teaching. Of course not. Never been exposed to it. I want to add one other dimension to this, and I think this is crucial, and you're going to run into it all the time. I do not think because a person has the gift of teaching, he can therefore teach at every level. Let me give you an illustration of this. We had a guy teaching in our junior department. He's a graduate engineer. And the kids were climbing the sides of the wall. And he was tearing his remaining hair out. And I can still remember him coming in with the quarterly, and he throws it down on the desk and says, Hendricks, it's 30. I'm through. I said, how come? Or he said, did you walk by the junior department recently? He said, I just can't control him. It's out of it. I don't have the gift of teaching. I said to him, Mike, I'm not sure. I said, maybe we have you in the wrong place. And right about that time, we were thinking of starting a college department. And, you know, the wheels start going around. And we put this guy into the college department. We got 64 college kids and started with two. And those college kids think this guy hung the moon. He's got real long words, and they think it's tremendous. They don't understand them always, but whoo. It's a real thinking man. Got a thinking man's filter. Evolution, friend, hit him anywhere. That guy will tackle any question you give him. He reads, he studies. Those kids latch onto him. They're over his home till the middle of the morning. They go to the university and get shot out of the saddle. They come running back to his place, and he gives them answers for all the questions that people raise who have scholarship to ask questions but not scholarship to answer them. Universities are loaded with these people. The shoddiest form of scholarship. Because of this guy, and boy, this guy really thinks. Whew! Then he goes back to campus, charged up again. We got a class out at SMU, I tell you, it's a Lulu. It's one of the humanities courses, it's a required course. Last time the professor started the course, the first thing he did, he said, how many of you kids in here believe the Bible is the Word of God? And these little kids in Methodist churches, you know, in the boondocks out in Texas, they put their hands up like this. So you know what I think of the Bible? Takes a Bible like this and goes, like this, right through the open window. This is the way they launch the class. These little kids from Sugar Creek, Texas. Batting their eyes. Wow. He loads more evangelicals in that one course than all of the university put together. It's a deliberately devised course to ask kids. And for the first time, we've been plugging up the holes. And you know who's been doing it? A guy who said, I don't have the gift of teaching. And he sure does. And if you're talking about teaching juniors, they think he's from off the ark. The 40s college kids. Third thing is the recognition of spiritual gifts by spirit-controlled men. This is the first thing we ask in an ordination exam. Are there any spirit-controlled men who recognize you have the gift of preaching? My friend, if you're preaching for 5 years and there's nobody filled with the Spirit who recognizes you got the gift of preaching, I got news for you. And this is one reason why a group is essential as a therapeutic corrective agent to help people. To recognize these gifts. And then the fourth and the last reason I give is the leadership of the Holy Spirit in your own life. And this is why it's so important to be under His control. And a number of us were talking after one of the sessions about thrilling realization of the Spirit of God developing peace in their own heart. This is their gift, and it's often a narrowing process. Conceivable you may have a number of gifts. But the Lord continues to lead you till finally it's this one I want to use and invest my life in. I have been in the pastorate and in preaching, nothing I love more. I left preaching, in the sense of a church, to go to a seminary to teach. Seminary is constantly trying to get me into administration. I think I have abilities in this area, but I don't want to move in that area. My greatest satisfaction and fulfillment in dependence upon the Spirit is teaching. I live to teach. And if I'm out of the classroom for 5 days, I'm very difficult to live with. I'm difficult to live with, period. It's is my bread and butter. I live for this type of thing. I can teach or preach in one church. I can teach in the seminary and move into hundreds of churches through a ministry of multiplication. That's what you're interested in. So you keep asking yourself and the Spirit of God as you're in fellowship with Him, what is it, Lord, you want me to do? I have no axe to grind. I'm available for you. I would say these are the primary means, Bob, that I would use. May I share just one thing and then we'll take us a break? Be sure to come back on time, will you, next time? Because, man, I'm loaded for bear this hour. Whoops. Meanwhile, back on the ranch. There we go. What's his gift? Different groups serve different purposes and therefore take different procedures. I deliberately devised a group which I call information giving, which as near as I can determine would be a good illustration of the type of group you often begin with in terms of the basics. In other words, you are dealing with a person who knows nothing. And you are going to give him some information as to how to get into the Word, as to how to start a memory program, as to how to establish a systematic quiet time. And it is primarily one-way communication. Now, we do not mean to imply by this that this could not be followed by question and answer. But you see, it is ridiculous to start with an individual who just received Christ as his Savior and say, let's have a discussion on the quiet time. On the what? Quiet time. I'm not a very quiet person. So he doesn't know what you're talking about. He needs information. Now, look at the same structure from a different standpoint. Now you are not facing with this individual with information giving, but information selling. Now you have two-way communication because you want this person to react in order to find out whether you're coming through or not, whether you understand what you're talking about. Let me show you two others in the realm of decision making. Here you are meeting as a group of representatives in an area. Area director. You get decision making. You are exploiting the resources of your group so that out of the center of this discussion will come meaningful decision. By the same token, you may be involved to solve a problem. And I thought of a good one last night as Warren was talking. He said, it is our goal to revise the TMS. It's a problem-solving situation. That's where I want to get the guy that's right down at the grassroots level to talk to him. What are the problems you face using this thing? What are the limitations of this? So you have problem-solving in which you have interaction across this entire group, moving in every conceivable direction. Not one way. But this man makes a statement, this man answers him. I don't think that's right. And I'll tell you why. This man says, well, I'm not too sure about that. And this man says, have you ever considered this? And it's in this cross-pollination of ideas that you really come to the solution to a basic problem. So your purpose
determine your procedure. When you change the purpose of the group from a information-giving session to a problem-solving group, you have to change the procedure. Now, next hour, we want to look at some of the ways of securing participation in these groups.
Facts of the matter are, the students think we're stuffy. We're removed on some cloud from where they live.
That's what's coming through.
See, so sometimes in connection with these, they may be wrong. Other times, we may be projecting the wrong
image.
Okay, what else? Come on, some of you deal with pastors. These are the guys that really give it to you. Yes, sir. Walt? All right, maybe we could put this narrow under this.
Even isolation under that same coin, I think. We've been accused of this possibility.
Isolationist?
I had in mind, for example, one time I was accused of being in the gospel of the body of Christ.
That's a delightful. Where's your public relations man? Be sure to put that in the next bulletin. George?
I think there's
another one here would be anti-church. And that's why pastors are gung-ho for you. Is that right? Boy, I'll tell you, friend. See, I'm viewing it now from the other side to help give you some evaluation. I get this shoved down my throat all the time. And I tell you, not because I'm trying to impress you, but because I don't mind coming to the defense of something I know is not true. But boy, an awful lot of people across America think you're anti-church. So whenever they see an ad walking the door, that's a threatening individual.
See, he's not going to help me. In fact, he probably thinks you're going to hinder him. Well, if you're going to hinder me in my work, you think I'm excited about you? So my first task is to get across to this guy. I'm on his team.
I want to help him. Well, if you ever get this across to him, you talk about communication. And you've taken giant steps. Anything else?
And higher education.
Can come sometimes with unguarded remarks, even about a person who has some training. I think, for example, and I think this is true, I know it's true, I think there are many navigators that I have met who know a lot more about the scriptures than many individuals who have graduated from theological seminary. But I would never suggest you tell somebody that. You believe that's true? And you messed up? I know a man graduated from a theological seminary with several advanced degrees and enrolled in the topical memory system in order to get some scripture under his belt.
That's true, but there's a difference between a true fact and the type of thing you project on individuals. And you go out running all over the place saying, boy, you went to seminary, you are a graduate of this school, you don't know from hunger.
See, boy, that goes down real hard, awfully hard to choke down. I mean, it's a blow to his pride. May I add that most of you are working with adults. And there's one good thing to keep in mind about working with adults. The greatest problem in adult learning is saving face.
He does not know, but he doesn't want you to know.
He doesn't know.
So you never start out by saying how dumb you are. I mean, he knows that.